Okay, I think we should get started now. I'm David Grusky, and I want to welcome you to the second debate in a quarter-long series of debates about how poverty and inequality are generated and what, if anything, we should be doing about reducing them. This debate is co-sponsored by the Stanford Center on Ethics and by the Elfenworks Foundation, and is hosted by the Stanford Center for the Study of Poverty and Inequality, a program within the Institute for Research in the Social Sciences. We are going to be focusing today on discrimination on the basis of looks or appearance. We'll ask in particular whether this type of discrimination is a serious or important type of discrimination. Is it a largely trivial matter, an issue that's best reserved for discussions in, say, People magazine? Or is it instead a quite fundamental matter, albeit one that's largely unappreciated? And then most importantly, we'll be asking whether or not it's properly the province of anti-discrimination law. Should we elaborate anti-discrimination law so as to encompass this type of discrimination? Let me turn to the introductions. We're very fortunate and honored to have with us here today Deborah Rohde, the Ernest McFarland Professor of Law, the founding director of the Stanford Center on Ethics, the former director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender at Stanford University, winner of too many awards to mention, longstanding advisor to the Bar Association, And many other organizations, and also in high-level politics as well. She's author or co-author of 19 books, mainly in the areas of legal ethics and gender equity. And the two most recent books by Deborah Rohde are Moral Leadership and then also Gender and Law. We're also very fortunate to have with us here today Richard Ford, the George E. Osborne Professor of Law, again here at Stanford Law School, a leading expert on civil rights and anti-discrimination law, and author of two very influential books published in the last several years. In a controversies debate last year, we featured some of the arguments that Richard Ford put forward in his book, Racial Culture, and now he's come out with another major entry, the book The Race Card, released a few months ago. And that book's generated enormous publicity, much debate, attracted much attention, and indeed, many of you may have seen his stellar performance on the Colbert Report, arguably one of the most difficult interviews around. So it's a real honor, then, to have both Deborah Rohde here with us today and also Richard Ford. So here's how we're going to go forward. We're going to start off with a 20-minute statement by Deborah Rohde, followed by a 20-minute statement by Richard Ford. Each will then have an opportunity for 5-minute rebuttals, and then we'll open up to questions from the audience. And we'll stop at 3:30 sharp. So welcome to both of them.
So it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm such a fan of all of the work done by the Center for Poverty and Inequality. And this particular subject is especially near and dear to my heart because I'm writing a book on the subject right now. And I thought perhaps I might just take a few minutes to explain how I backed into the topic and why I think it's important, and a couple of the ways in which Rich Ford, with whom I'm almost always agree, have a difference of view on this particular subject. And then Rich will give you a fuller account of his view. The origins of the project really started when I was chairing the American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession, and I was at a meeting of the Bar Association in London, trapped with very high-powered women wearing very high heels. And I won't bore you with all of the details of the story, except to say that it was a typical American Bar Association event in which there were no cabs, compounded by a shutdown of the subway system because there had been a bomb scare. And then the Queen Mother was having a birthday, which tied traffic up in the park. And the meetings were at different points in the city. And I was with women who were incapable of walking. In footwear designed for anything but. And, literally, it got in the way of life, and it struck me as one of those petty indignities. I've always viewed shoe design as the last refuge for closet misogynists, and it was borne out by this experience. Coming back on the plane, it's a very long ride from London with 11 hours. I was flipping through some of the tabloids that they give you on the planes, and there were all these advertisements for footwear, you know, women's shoe fashions. It was July. Each one of them, you know, less adapted to the purpose for which shoes were originally meant. You know, just spike heels with this little tiny straps, killer shoes, we used to call them in high school. So I penned off a kind of irritated op-ed, and on a lark, my husband said, well, why don't you send it to the New York Times? And I laughed because, you know, I've been sending op-eds to the New York Times on serious subjects related to gender before. This, however, was the one that they took. And they deleted the sentence that started with, in a world in which 4 million women are victims of domestic violence and 20 million live in poverty, shoes are not at the high, you know, point of the feminist agenda. Nonetheless, I went on to say they're one of these things that keeps women back literally as well as figuratively. And then I went on to give some statistics about foot problems. It turns out 80% of women have them, most of them related to high heels. Women account for 80% of foot surgeries and so forth. So, this particular op-ed probably generated more correspondence than anything I've ever written. People, you know, just weighed in on this subject, men as well as women, men who'd been trapped with their wives wearing this inappropriate footwear, you know, shoe manufacturers, shoe doctors, everyone suggesting that I'd put my finger on a really important social problem. And then the few whiners who said, in a world in which 40 million women are, you know, in poverty, you pick shoes for your 10 seconds of fame, which was really irritating, I must say. But after that, I sort of began to pay more attention to the foot issue. And when I was working on a book on sources of women's inequality, an agent sent me a clipping that described the newest thing in cosmetic foot surgery, which is women getting their toes sculpted to fit in fashionable shoes. And, you know, foot surgery is not a trivial operation, and in fact, in like 30% of cases, you make your problems worse. And it's extremely painful, and the notion that people would do this for the sake of footwear, and, you know, this in a nation in which 40 million women lack health insurance. It turns out cosmetic surgery, including foot surgery, is the fastest growing medical specialty. So what's going on here, and why is this issue, I wondered, one in which the women's movement, which has made so much progress on other issues affecting women's equality, done so very little on this? Women are still spending grossly disproportionate amounts of time and energy and are still disproportionately affected by discrimination related to appearance. And as a legal scholar, I was also interested in what, if anything, law and social policy can do about it and why there had been so little interest in a culture that seeped and civil rights rhetoric for thinking about this as a serious issue of discrimination. What makes this different? The more research that I've done on the topic, the more convinced I am that it isn't a trivial problem. And if you look at any particular manifestation, it seems that way. But when you accumulate them and see how much time, energy, expense, and social anguish are consumed around appearance issues, it seems to be a pretty big deal in most people's lives. The paper that you have sets out a few of the relevant facts, but among those that I found truly astounding is the fact that most individuals, women, say they would rather marry an embezzler or a drug dealer or a shoplifter than someone who was fat. Two-thirds would rather be stupid than fat. Three-quarters of women say that it's the most important issue affecting their self-image. 90% of women consider it very important. This is borne out just by the financial expenditures alone. In global terms, we spend something on the order of $200 billion on appearance-related services and projects, $18 billion on cosmetic surgery, $40 billion on diets, many of which have little to do with health and everything to do with appearance. Enormous amounts of this money is wasted. Something on the order of 80 to 90% of cosmetic products are what experts refer to as cosmetic hoo-ha. And as many of you know, about 90% of those on diets return to their average weight within 2 years. So we're spending a huge amount of time and effort and on an issue that many regard as incredibly important, far more important than you would think it ought to be in a society which claims to value other factors related to, as Rich calls it, intrinsic merit, much more importantly. We know that appearance is a major source of inequality, and why this should cause us concern, I want to suggest, is related to several major problems. First of all, it undermines our commitment to equal opportunity and distribution of important things like jobs, education, on the basis of merit, not superficial attributes. And these kinds of inaccurate stereotypes affect almost every form of employment that is not directly, objectively correlated or related to things like physical labor. And so you see, even in areas like, for example, law, economists have figured out what the premium is for attractiveness, and it gives you a return of something on the order of 15 to 20% in terms of increased income over a lifetime. Secondly, it undermines self-esteem and individuals' own sense of identity and importance. It subordinates an already subordinated group, women, but also it particularly, by objectifying women in a particular sort of way, often based on classically Anglo-American images of the slender, white, attractive woman, devalues racial and ethnic features, punishes those who are obese, which affects women of lower socioeconomic status and women of color disproportionately, and also carries enormous health costs. It is true, of course, that extreme overweight is a major health risk, but so too is underweight and the eating disorders that are connected to it. And much of the available evidence suggests that for most people, the key issue related to health is fitness, not overweight per se. And the patterns of yo-yo dieting that are induced by an appearance-obsessed culture are not conducive to physical health. And finally, it restricts self-expression and self-identity in some important ways. Rich has written about one famous case, a cornrows case, in which an airline prohibited a stewardess from wearing a hairstyle that was associated not exclusively with African-American women, but predominantly with them. There are many other examples, and in the paper I talk about one, the Harrah's Casino example, in which after many trips up and down courts of appeal, an en banc federal appellate court finally decided that it was not a form of sex discrimination to have and grooming code that imposed on women the obligation to have hair teased and styled, to wear makeup, and to have manicured nails, whereas men only had to have clean nails that were short and neatly trimmed. What does all of this have to do with being a bartender? Apparently not much, because all of the job evaluations of the woman who ultimately challenged this particular grooming regulation had been extremely positive. And for her, it wasn't a trivial issue. It objectified and denigrated her to put on this level of makeup and suggested that somehow her job performance was tied up in things that had nothing to do with what she considered the nature of the job to be, which was to be personable to customers and to be able to control unruly drunks. And she thought that dressing up in the way that Harris was prescribing, in fact, got in the way of that. Ironically enough, the federal judges had difficulty seeing how these kinds of grooming requirements impose differential burdens on men and women, as if cleaning your fingernails was the same as putting on makeup, teasing and styling your hair, and having your nails appropriately polished and manicured. So one could ask, what planet are federal judges living on that, you know, they don't realize how long it takes to do all that? But the broader issue, to not see this as an issue of sex inequality, is what I think stands in the way. So why is it that so many people don't? And in public opinion polls, you find that folks are about evenly divided over whether they think this should be an area where discrimination law should have a role and where it should be unlawful to discriminate on the basis of employment. About 39% think it should be okay for employers to do this. About a third think it shouldn't. Interestingly enough, women and people of color are much more likely to see it as problematic. The arguments for why it's trivial, well, customer preferences, and you see this advanced by businesses all the time. You know, sex sells. So whether it's Hooters restaurants or the Bogota babes who are subject to stringent weight limitations, high heel requirements, et cetera, or the examples that Rich describes in his book, in which high-end hotels have want to hire only service personnel who conform to a certain image, or only bartenders who add to the sexual allure of the restaurant. So what is the job description? And why not let employee preferences matter in that way? Well, I think for a couple of reasons. First of all, oftentimes employers are just wrong about what the employees actually prefer. There was no evidence that people cared that much about whether Darlene Jesperson was wearing makeup or having her hair styled. And in other cases that have been brought under the few jurisdictions that have anti-discrimination ordinances, like San Francisco, for example, an overweight aerobics instructor sued and was able to demonstrate that she was fit, that her aerobics classes were filled. In fact, after she was hired for not projecting the appropriate fit image, she went on and filled aerobics classes in another dance provider's studio. So it's oftentimes based on irrational assumptions about what customers want. But even if there is some basis in some instances, we don't normally think of customer preferences as a rationale for discrimination. And in fact, the law, civil rights law, is quite clear that it doesn't count. And you can obviously see why the law would have evolved in that direction. If every black shop owner had been able to claim in the 1960s and 70s, well, people just won't buy from black salespeople, and that had been an adequate defense, we'd still be fighting a lot more battles around race discrimination than we now are. We also know that jobs like flight attendants on airplanes used to be restricted to women on the curious ground of what I've elsewhere described as either the flying womb or the flying bordello defense. The notion was that women were maternal and particularly comforting to passengers on airlines, or alternatively, that sexy stewardesses sold airline tickets, and therefore the airlines had a justification for having only female flight attendants. Well, anybody who's traveled the air recently realized that we've all pretty much been able to survive the trauma of cross-coastal flights with male flight attendants, and the notion somehow that the primary function of a flight attendant is to sell sex is something that I think has been rightly called into question, and it ought to be with respect to any of these other jobs. finally, I think a lot of people think that just an appearance-related prohibition is going to end up trivializing sex discrimination law. And this is the argument that I think Rich Ford eloquently sets forth in his book, and we'll talk about more here. And I will just say that as a factual matter, I'm not sure it's true. I've looked at the jurisdictions that now have these ordinances. One state, Michigan, has height and weight ordinances, and a few cities do. Rich talks some in his book about Santa Cruz, which he paints as kind of a throwback to hippiedom, in which a bunch of lefties shove this ordinance through the legislature to protect people of unconventional appearance. In fact, there haven't been any lawsuits under the Santa Cruz ordinance, in part because it restricts appearance discrimination to things that are inherent and also gives employers a grooming defense. So in point of fact, the law has been mainly symbolic there. In other jurisdictions, it's been symbolic as well. San Francisco's only had a couple of cases. In Michigan, they've averaged about one lawsuit a year and maybe 30 complaints. But some of those complaints are real complaints. They're complaints about weight discrimination. They're complaints like Darlene Jesperson's. And incidentally, one good thing about policies like this is they give people the leverage of publicity. And that's what's exactly happened with the aerobics instructor. It's what happened when Jesperson was able to bring her claim because she claimed it was sex inequality. And what the result has been in a number of these cases is the aerobic studios have changed their policies. Harrah's Casino dropped its makeup requirement, so did a number of airlines when they were subject to this kind of challenge. So I think the main rationale for these prohibitions is not that this is the most important source of inequality for women, certainly not that it's the most important civil rights legislation on the books, but it's not likely to devalue other forms of civil rights protection. District of Columbia and Michigan, two of the places that have this, no sign that civil rights enforcement has grown less vigorous as a consequence. And every reason to think that the few people who bring these suits and who are able to claim under them are going to be people that we're basically sympathetic to and who are raising our public consciousness, even if they don't always get a legal remedy, as to what some of the social costs of appearance discrimination really are. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for listening to what I have to say. It's great to be here. I enjoyed our last debate last year, and I'm sure I will this one too. I have a lot of sympathy for some of the cultural arguments that Deborah's making about the costs of obsessive grooming standards and norms, high-heeled shoes, obsession with youth that is a problem in our society. And also, I have some sympathy with the arguments about gender equity, and I'll say a little bit about why I think those are distinct, however, from the general run of claims involving appearance discrimination. I share some of the frustration with institutions that focus obsessively on looks. Here, I'll just give you an example. Deborah mentioned bartenders. I had a favorite bar in San Francisco. It was called the Redwood Room in the Clift Hotel. Actually, as it turned out, I proposed to my wife there, so I have some personal connection to it. And I proposed to her there when it was under different management and when the criterion for hiring the staff appeared to be skill at mixing cocktails and good conversation and skill at delivering them promptly to the table before they got warm. These are qualities I look for in watering holes. And it turns out that now it's under new management. And when the new management took over the Clift Hotel, they put a full-page ad in the San Francisco Chronicle that read, "Casting Call." And you can imagine what happened after that. The idea was that the new staff were going to be runway model gorgeous, Hollywood heartthrob, good looking, and that's in fact the criterion that they employed. Not that I have anything against that, but it turned out that in order to employ a staff with these characteristics, the skill at mixing the drinks and delivering them to the table on time kind of started to decline. And so there was a little bit of a hydraulic relationship between those two skills. It seemed to be in the minority in this view, and in fact, the Redwood Room at the Clift Hotel, as much as I regret and lament the changes, is one of the more popular places in town. It's mobbed on Saturday nights. People are lined up in front to get into the place. And so the management knew something about the market that apparently I didn't. And there's a question to be asked about whether we would want to prohibit the for people who apparently appreciate that in favor of my preferences. I want to say a little more about that. There's no doubt that there's some unfairness involved, and I have to say I really felt for the old staff who I thought were quite good at their jobs, who were undoubtedly let go because the hotel had decided to pursue a policy that focused almost to the exclusion of other virtues on physical appearance. So why not have a law to prohibit it? It's unfair. We have other civil rights laws that prohibit things that are unfair, like the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, sex, color, national origin, and religion. Well, why not? And those are unfair, and we passed a law against them, and we enforce it. And employers are afraid to discriminate on those bases. They're worried about lawsuits, and their behavior's improved. So why not add other things to the list? That's, I think, the general impulse. The basic idea there is that underlying the Civil Rights Act is a general prohibition or a general resistance to job criterion that are unfair. And the list, the enumerated prohibited forms of discrimination are just specific instances of this larger evil. Employers making arbitrary or unfair decisions when hiring or firing their employees. And we just listed the worst ones. But we haven't finished the job. Discrimination against the short, the fat, the homely, or people with unconventional fashion senses, these are all other iterations of unfair discrimination, and we ought to attack those as well. Why not? Why not pass a law to prohibit all those things? Well, I'll give you a little shadow of what we might want to worry about. This is a quote from a Kurt Vonnegut short story called Harrison Bergeron. Everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and before the law. They were equal in every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution and the unceasing vigilance of the agents of the United States Handicapper General. There were laws to keep smart people from taking unfair advantage of their brains. And in the story, one of the characters is unusually smart, and he has to wear a device that buzzes in his ear every few minutes so he can't concentrate. So it'll bring his effective intelligence down to the average level. There were laws to keep ballerinas were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked so that no one seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face would feel like something that the cat drug in. So I suppose the question I want to pose is, where do reasonable civil rights prohibitions end and the reign of the handicapper general begins? And despite my sympathies, I think the reasonable laws end somewhere north of laws prohibiting appearance discrimination. Now, what's the difference? We've already established that they're both dealing with unfairness of various kinds. So what's the difference between the unfairness suffered when an employer discriminates on the basis of race or sex, as opposed to that when they discriminated on the basis of unconventional grooming? I'd argue that Congress, when it passed the Civil Rights Act, was dealing with this specific set of types of discrimination because they're not just instances of individual unfairness, but also of social inequity, that they're social evils that create and there are created by systemic and institutionalized forms of discrimination that have wide-ranging effects. So it's not just this individual this time who's discriminated against because of his or her race, but racism has led to segregated ghettos. It's led to social unrest and race riots. It's led to the systematic loss of job opportunities, not just for one individual one time, but each and every time. So in a world in which racism and racial discrimination was the norm, it wasn't that this one employer didn't hire you because you were black. It was that every employer that you encountered didn't hire you because you were black for any of the good jobs. And it wasn't just you, but it was your family. It was your parents and your siblings and everybody in your segregated neighborhood that faced the same type of discrimination, such that entire communities were kept down by a system of discrimination that had, and it's worth noting that these communities were interdependent, and so the fact that I can't get a good job, and my parents couldn't get a good job, and my sister can't get a good job, all because of race, led to an impoverishment of communities. And that's different than an individual instance of unfairness, however bad that may be. And that was the kind of evil that Congress was trying to confront in the context of race discrimination. By contrast, the world has never seen a ghetto populated by the unconventionally, what would conventionally be called homely. And there's never been a white riot. These aren't social problems. They may be instances of unfairness, but they're not social problems, and that makes them different and less severe. Not trivial. I don't argue trivial, but less severe. And so the question is, when will we bring what the philosopher Brian Berry called the ponderous machinery of the law to bear on a problem? And it seems to me that the arguments for bringing it to bear on something like racism are much more powerful than the arguments for bringing it to bear on something like appearance discrimination for this reason. Sexism is a little bit different of a case, but I still think an equally strong case can be made for laws against sexism. There aren't ghettos populated by women, but there is a feminization of poverty that's well known. Single women in particular are disproportionately represented among the poor. And sexism more also creates a pervasive social order that confines women to positions of relative powerlessness, not only society-wide, but within families. It presents them with physical vulnerability and, in some cases, social condescension or contempt. And again, by contrast, there's no notion of fat people's work, whereas there is a notion of women's work. There's no idea that ugly people belong in the home, whereas there is the idea that women belong in the home. So these are different. And again, it's the systematic nature and the comprehensive nature of the discrimination and its results that justify the extraordinary extension of the of legal coercion that civil rights laws represent. And you don't have that in the other cases. And we don't have to think they're trivial. So that's why we have the law, and I think those reasons apply differently. In other words, the analogy, and this is what I talk about in my book, these cases which almost always are justified by analogy to racism. So you'll have quotes where someone will say, it's just like racism, or if I were black, they'd never get away with this. And I'm suggesting that that analogy is inappropriate, that we can't leapfrog the need to make the specific argument for the specific legal prohibitions by saying it's just like racism, and that when you're confronted with actually having to make the specific argument, the argument doesn't look as strong as one might think if you begin with the assumption that they're all analogous. Lots of advantages and disadvantages that people suffer are unfair, and the law doesn't, and I would suggest can't, prohibit them all. I'll say a little more about what's involved in the prohibition of discrimination later so that you can get an idea of why there are costs that have to be borne when we prohibit discrimination, and we have to ask whether it's worth it. But there are lots of advantages and disadvantages that are unfair. There's no doubt. Good looks are an advantage. Tall height is an advantage. You may remember Dennis Kucinich's joke when he was on the campaign trail where he said at a debate, well, you know, you can have a president that was against the war and, you know, will work for the working person and fix the problems in Washington, or you can have somebody who's tall. And, you know, the suggestion there, which I think was right, was that, well, lots of times the voters pick tall. This is unfortunate, and it's bad for the country. So height is an advantage, and it's true. I don't dispute the statistics that Deborah cited, that what's conventionally thought of as good looks and height give advantages to people in the labor market. And those advantages are due to something that's entirely unearned. Or maybe not entirely unearned, because we could say that good looks are probably a combination of inherited advantages, things like facial symmetry and height, and also effort of various kinds. And we'll get back to effort in a minute and whether the effort's justified. But largely unearned. But let's look at some other types of advantages that are unearned as well. Intelligence, for instance, is largely innate. It's cultivated as well, a lot like looks, but it's largely innate. I think most biologists would agree. And so far, no one's proposed prohibiting discrimination on the basis of intelligence, even in jobs where a lot of intelligence isn't required. We could imagine a regime in which, like the handicapper general, we said, well, just how important is it that this employee is highly intelligent? You're discriminating on that basis. What if this one that's not quite as sharp could do the job pretty well? And check. So far, we haven't proposed doing that. So perhaps it should worry us a bit that we're willing to allow some unearned advantages, like those that come from unearned intelligence, to lie where they fall, but we want to deprive other people of theirs. In other words, if people with high IQs ought to be allowed to benefit from them, why not people with high cheekbones? Cost of more enforcement, because that's the last question. I mean, if enforcement were free and it was easy to go about it, then we might say, well, yeah, we should police for all this stuff. In fact, maybe we should even police for inherited intelligence and make the employer demonstrate that the level of intelligence they require for the job is actually required by the job, and we'd have a more egalitarian society, and why not do it? But there are costs to more enforcement. It's worth noting that the way the law deals now with invidious discrimination in many contexts is to ask whether or not the criterion is job related. And so very quickly we get to a sticky type of analysis about whether or not the grooming in question is related enough to the job to be a legitimate job requirement or not. We could say something similar about height and good looks. I mean, many people may say, look, if it's a bartender at the Clift Hotel, that's invidious discrimination if they consider looks and height. But what about fashion model? Are we quite ready to say that people hiring fashion models can't consider looks and height? At least if we are, we're talking about a quite radical transformation of society, not the kind of thing that we typically associate with civil rights, but in fact a real radical cultural transformation, and it may be that we should have that cultural transformation. I question whether or not law is the appropriate mechanism to produce it. But anyway, if you don't say that, then you've got to start to ask, well, when is it related to the job and when isn't it? And the history of courts adjudicating job relatedness in other contexts is not encouraging. It's a difficult judicial inquiry. It's one that we do when the stakes are high enough, when it's important enough, but it's one that consistently causes time-consuming and vexatious litigation, and it's one that's consistently controversial. There's a cost there. More than that, there's a cost in terms of public sympathy and concentration. A lot of the work that the Civil Rights Act has done isn't done by successful lawsuits by plaintiffs. Instead, it was done when people, in part prodded by the risk of lawsuits and also prodded by changing social attitudes, started to take seriously the obligation to avoid various types of discriminatory conduct. And now if you go into your typical big firm, a big law firm or a big accounting firm or big business, you have sensitivity training courses, you have diversity consultants, you have people whose job it is to try to get management to think about gender equity or to think about racial diversity. And people sit in seminars. The state of California, for instance, requires managers to take a mandatory every 2 year several hour sex harassment course. Now, there's a limit to the amount of time that a busy CEO or a law firm partner who gets paid by the hour, who bills by the hour, will sit in sensitivity workshops and diversity training. And we better pick the things that we want to focus on carefully. I would suggest that we may already be pretty close to the limit of people's patience for those types of legal mandates and culture and interventions. And a business community united in frustration at a bloated civil rights regime may well become a potent force for reform or even, God forbid, repeal. And if we've convinced everybody that all forms of discrimination are analogous, who then will make the distinction between the more important ones and the less important when the backlash occurs? That's a potential cost. Am I out of time, or do I have a couple more seconds? The one last thing I'd say is that it's true that right now the few cities and jurisdictions that have laws against things like appearance and weight discrimination haven't had a lot of lawsuits. But I guess that seems to be kind of an odd argument in favor of them. The fact that no one's availing themselves of the legal protections is a little bit of a troubling argument in favor of the protections. Surely we would hope, if we supported the laws, that we'd have more lawsuits. And it's worth noting that a big part of the reason we don't have more lawsuits is because the legislation as it's currently written doesn't have much in the way of enforcement teeth. The local governments aren't empowered to actually impose the type of legal remedies that would lead to lawsuits. In fact, even in the San Francisco case involving the overweight jazzercise instructor, the City Human Rights Commission was only empowered to broker some sort of a settlement with jazzercise, but they weren't empowered to do things like impose penalties or push injunctions. And so if we really took the analogy seriously and had the same type of legal remedies that we do now for race and sex discrimination, I expect we would see a lot more lawsuits, and some of the concerns that I have about the use of judicial resources and backlash might come to bear. Okay, thank you.
So I guess I'll just say a few things about where I see Rich and I differing. First, the analogy between race and sex discrimination and what he referred to as unconventional grooming. I think that really misstates the comparison. I'm not objecting to grooming requirements or things that are objectively related to the jobs. What I'm objecting to are requirements that aren't demonstrably related and that go well beyond grooming or that impose grossly disproportionate burdens. And the claim that I'm making doesn't depend on seeing a direct analogy between racism and appearance-related discrimination. I wouldn't claim that they stand on the same footing in terms of the systemic social consequences, and I agree with Rich that lots of things are unfair and we don't want to prohibit them all. But I don't see this as a trivial form of discrimination either. And it strikes me as quite different than, say, intelligence, which we appropriately don't prohibit as a job criteria, because we think, on the whole, in most jobs, it is relevant. Even in the ones that don't require rocket science, being smarter is usually a pretty functional trait. And high intelligence is just not the same as high cheekbones in that respect. And finally, and most importantly, I think we just greatly differ over what we think the costs of enforcement would be. He said that federal courts don't have a good record in figuring out what's job-related. I guess we're reading the record a little differently. I think they do as well with that kind of question as they do with a lot of others in employment discrimination cases. They figured out, for example, that flight attendant, physical attractiveness was not job-related. I think that was a pretty good call. It's transformed the flight industry, and not only has it opened jobs to male flight attendants, it's upped the prestige and salary for female attendants. you know, fashion models, another one. Well, okay, yeah, that's probably one where appearance is related. Does that mean that the law never has any role if the standards are such that they really push people into a state of chronic underweight? We've seen a couple European jurisdictions crack down on some of the high fashion modeling shows because so many of the models were at serious physical risk. Several even died from anorexia. I wouldn't find that form of intervention terribly unappealing. That's not to say that you want the handicapper generally making decisions about who should be in fashion ads or not, but I don't think fashion model is the appropriate prototype for most jobs in this country, where high cheekbones and abnormal thinness are truly not relevant factors for performance. I think that also, quite the contrary, the fact that there aren't very many lawsuits brought under these ordinances is an argument for suggesting we're not going to run into the bloated civil rights regime that's going to produce backlash and repeal of genuine civil rights legislation that responds to real injuries. It just hasn't been the history in the places that have this discrimination. The few cases where plaintiffs win are ones where you kind of look at the record and you think they should have won. The nurse who's kicked out of nursing school because she's overweight and people think she won't be a good role model in making health suggestions to patients. Or the jazz exercise instructor, or the many other areas in which overweight for bus drivers and for people performing jobs that have very little to do with standards of physical appearance as they relate to performance. In those kinds of cases, I think you want a legal remedy, not because you think it's going to be invoked very often, not because you necessarily want a lot of teeth in it. Rich is right in pointing out how these ordinances function, but because you want to give some leverage to people to force employers to take a second look at standards that really do, I think, cause serious problems. Another case in which the San Francisco Commission was called upon to intervene had to do with weight standards for 7 and 8 year old kids trying out for ballet school. What resulted from that commission intervention was some attention to issues of eating disorder among would-be ballerinas, which, as we know from many of the published memoirs and case studies, as well as medical evidence, is a serious problem. So I think what you're hoping for here is that you can marshal the law to be an effective agent for social change, not one that's going to bankrupt businesses, but one that's going to attract some needed attention to the cultural consequences and really debilitating personal and social self-esteem issues that accompany appearance-related discrimination.
Quickly, I don't deny that some good would be done by a regime that prohibited these various forms of appearance-based discrimination. And it is worth noting that we might want to make a distinction between things like grooming and dress codes and things like weight and things like physical appearance as measured by something like facial symmetry. They think that they raise different issues in part because they have they respond to different levels of effort and volitional change, and they're on a spectrum. But leaving that aside, I don't deny that some good could be done in raising public awareness of real issues and of remedying real injustices. But again, the question is whether or not it's worth the cost. In terms of job relatedness, the federal standard for job relatedness, my claim isn't that the federal courts do a bad job. It's that it's a very difficult job to do, and it's a job that, even when done well, does impose some costs on the businesses that are subject to the regulation. A typical case involving job relatedness would involve the standardized test that's imposed by the courts. That's where the job relatedness standard came from. So the business has a standardized test, and it turns out to have a disparate impact, what we call in law a disparate impact, on the basis of race. It screens out a disproportionate number of people of a particular race. Under present law, the employer is required to defend the standardized test as job related. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean It's on average a cheap and dirty way to go about getting a slightly better workforce. That's not good enough. That's what all the standardized tests would meet that standard. Instead, it's got to be much more exacting. And the question of how exacting, how particularly related to this job, what does what's the real criterion for the job as opposed to criterion that just help us make more of a profit? Those are very, very hard questions to answer, and I think they would be equally hard, in fact, even harder to answer in the context of appearance discrimination. The reason I raised the fashion models as a case wasn't to suggest that most jobs are like fashion models, but to suggest that there are a lot of jobs that are on a spectrum between, let's say, fashion model on the one hand and, let's say, a data entry clerk on the other hand, someone who types in a room with a job that has objective criterion and that no one ever sees. So you'd say, look, if you're a data entry clerk, the employer should care about how quickly and accurately you enter the data. That's it. And if they're thinking about your weight or your height or your looks, that's not job related. That's an easy case. Fashion model, easy case that looks are job related. But let's take something like, someone in cosmetic sales. Well, gee, there are a combination of things they're doing. One, they're ringing up the cosmetics. They're trying to sell you on the cosmetics to get you to buy them. But on the other hand, it's pretty clear that they're serving an advertising function that's a little bit like a fashion model. And it's not an accident that most of the people doing that have a particular look. It's a combination of grooming requirements and just the employer choosing people with that look. I'm hard-pressed to say how much of that looks are job-related in that context. And at least Jazzercise's claim for the aerobics instructor was pretty similar, that the aerobics instructor not only teaches the classes and imparts information, but is also sort of an advertisement for an industry, one of the main draws of which is that it's going to help you lose weight. And so that, I'm hard-pressed to say that that's entirely unjob-related. I may not like the world in which that's job-related, but I think the courts are reaching pretty far when the objective is to say that people shouldn't want to lose weight or that they should want to do aerobics for some reason other than losing weight. And at that point, it starts to look job-related. Now, again, it's true. In the typical civil rights regime, we don't allow things like customer preference to be a defense. But that's precisely because the stakes are so high. Again, this distinction I'm making, not saying that the appearance related discrimination is trivial, but that it's not as important as those enumerated in the Civil Rights Act, and we're willing to pay the cost in terms of expensive judicial enforcement, the cost in terms of expensive litigation, and the cost in terms of arguably job-related rules that the employer has to forego because of the systemic nature of the discrimination, because of the interrelated nature of the communities, because it has social ramifications as well as individual ones. That's a cost I think we might hesitate to pay in these other cases. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Something beauty being job-related or not job-related being a spectrum rather than a certain point. And if you're actually going to make a law about something like this, how would you define where along that spectrum it cuts off?
Well, I agree that it's a spectrum. But I think the burden ought to be on the employer to demonstrate that there's a legitimate basis for imposing an appearance requirement. So what might that be? I grant some of Rich's examples, cosmetic sales. But take a case that was actually litigated because the company had an overt policy, this is Abercrombie & Fitch, of wanting its sales force to have a certain kind of preppy look. And what that turned out to exclude was people of color, as well as women who didn't exude the right kind of, I suppose I would probably, have attire that would pass today. But a lot of people were screened out. There have been other cases where a sales manager was silly enough to say something like, get me someone hot. You know, those kinds of cases, I think we don't want to say it's a legitimate basis, that all sorts of folks can sell clothes. And even if we thought that people arguably like to be served by attractive people, as we know they do from the studies, and I mentioned in the paper all the studies that indicate that people are just more likely to do almost anything when an attractive person asks, whether it's buying cosmetics or, you know, purchasing legal services. I don't think we think that that's the world in which we want to live, and I think there are contexts in which we say, you know, if you're going to have an overt policy that does this, you ought to be able to show that it's seriously related to the job. And it shouldn't just be a matter of customer preference for the reasons that I suggested earlier. We don't like some of those preferences, just as we didn't like them in the context of race or sex when people use those preferences to prefer someone. And without saying that appearance is exactly similar in its systemic social consequences, I think we can say it oughtn't to be the basis for those sorts of cases. And I think the few instances in which somebody's going to actually spend the money to litigate it are going to be ones where the facts are pretty sympathetic to why this isn't a bona fide occupational qualification. And that's certainly what the limited data that we have on enforcement of these ordinances suggests. You know, I've looked at all the claims that have been brought in Michigan and D.C., and, you know, you don't find any more frivolous or vexatious examples of this than you do under any of the other civil rights statutes that Rich is fully wanting to keep in force. So I just don't see it as a huge cost, and I do see some costs in non-enforcement.
Those social groups are subject to more systemic sort of oppression. I'm a little unclear about that because it seems that that might be the case when those laws were passed. Mm-hmm. But like today, I mean, we still rely on those laws, and maybe for race and for sex, that's still valid. But what about for like religion? It seems to me there isn't like a systemic discrimination against someone who's a Buddhist or a Baptist or someone who's, say, French.
Well, but in some cases there is. Muslim would be a pretty easy example of a group that I think almost certainly would suffer a great deal of systemic discrimination and does, actually, but would suffer more but for anti-discrimination laws. So, and religion has a long history of generating social strife and oppression and discord. It's probably the first category of really serious group-based viciousness that, at least in Western society. And so it's quite understandable that we want to ensure that we don't wind up with a society of warring religious groups that are attacking each other. And so, you're picking some examples where there's not much discrimination. Again, you said French. Well, maybe not French, but what about Mexican? Mexican-Americans, I think, actually do suffer a great deal of national origin discrimination, that there's a lot of belief among a distressingly large part of the population that people from Latin America are stealing our jobs or they're sneaking over the border or something along those lines. So there is systemic discrimination. Now, it's not the same in each case, but I do think you can make a strong case for both of those. Let me say one other thing. I don't claim that the list that is in the current federal civil rights law is exhaustive. That's not my claim. My claim is that before we extend that type of extraordinary legal protection, we'd want to see some form of serious, pervasive, systemic discrimination that makes it worth the cost. Another group that I'd add, sexual orientation. That seems to be one that merits the extension of civil rights law. So I don't mean just what we had in the 1960s and that's it. But I'm not convinced that the same thing extends to appearance, grooming, and weight.
Yeah.
Do you think the increasing prevalence of obesity, for example, in society is going to make the problem better or worse in the sense that either they'll just be more people facing this sort of discrimination, or that it'll just become the norm,
That's a great question. So I think it's hard to say right now. I mean, one aspect of the move to have anti-discrimination law on the basis of weight is the belief that we're just going to keep becoming heavier and heavier as a society. It's going to become the norm, and employers ought to accommodate it. There was a famous case involving Southwest Airlines, or not case, but dispute involving Southwest Airlines that passed what they called a customer of size policy. And the policy was that if you couldn't fit in the coach class seat and put down both the armrests, then they would ask you to buy two seats. And a lot of organizations got very angry about this policy. One of them said something like, it's just a civil rights issue. If it was blacks, no one would let them get away with this. I'm entitled to as much space as I take up. Now, it's not obvious to me that the right solution is Southwest policy. And I, as much as anybody, would like to see airline seats get a little bigger. I think it'd be better for everybody. But there is a cost involved in that, which is higher fares. And so far, it looks like the market has spoken. People prefer, you know, they buy based on price. That they wouldn't want to spend the extra 25, 30, 50% in ticket fares in order to get bigger seats. So it's hard to say whether the outcome that we should push for is the category of people who are overweight but could lose weight through diet and exercise. We want to encourage to do that, and that would suggest not anti-discrimination law, but you know, its opposite, at least allowing the employers to have the policies that the market produces, or whether society is just going to continue to get more obese, and at some point there'll be political pressure. But by that point, there'll probably also be economic pressure. I mean, if we get to the point where you're having a huge number of people who can't fit comfortably into the seats that the airlines are offering, then I expect the airlines will respond to that without the need for civil rights laws. So I don't think I've answered your predictive question, but I've tried to put it in the context of the debate.
Yeah, I think I would only add that one of the troubling aspects of weight discrimination is the fact that it is also associated with sex and class. Weight matters more. Women are more penalized than men are. And lower income, especially minority women, are much more likely to be obese, and they're much more likely to suffer the social costs that come with inappropriate determinations based on weight standards. And part of the problem, I think, now is that the current legislation is really out of touch with the social realities of this. Weight is viewed as a disability under the Americans with Disability Act only in a very small percentage of cases, like 2% of the population of overweight individuals who are chronically and extremely obese. And in those cases, the law gives a remedy. They're viewed as disabled, but those are precisely the people who are most unlikely to be able to do the job as required by employers in many of these situations. So ironically, just giving them the remedy in this case misses the population that are most penalized by weight discrimination, the context in which they're not chronically or seriously obese, they're just overweight, and the appearance alone, the unattractiveness, makes them unattractive employees. And those are the kinds of cases that I think we ought to worry about. And the confusion between overweight and unfit is getting in the way of, I think, appropriate cultural thinking about what the social health costs and targets of appropriate social interventions ought to be. So I would hope that as we get more understanding, first of all, about how hard it is for people to actually lose weight in many instances, how many jobs are subject to discrimination where it isn't demonstrably related to performance, that we begin to see a saner way to take both cultural and legal steps to providing more remedies.
Why do you think law is the arena to
Well, I don't think it's the most important arena. But I think that what the history of women's rights, gay rights, disability rights, and civil rights more generally has shown is that law is a powerful tool for raising cultural consciousness about the extent of discrimination and the social costs of it. And one analogy that I give in the paper is sex harassment law, which when it was first viewed as a form of sex discrimination under Title VII, courts had a lot of trouble seeing why, you know, the federal government should be providing remedies for what they called the petty slights of the hypersensitive. And there was a whole lot of worry about the slippery slopes, and the federal government would have, you know, judges would become chaperones, and what was and what wasn't wanted, sexual behavior, et cetera, et cetera. What we know now is that sex harassment is a significant social problem, that it imposes significant costs on employers due to job turnover and retention problems, that it gets in the way of job performance in serious ways, that it leads many individuals to have significant problems both in dealing with their own workplace situation and in finding new forms of work, and it's a way of perpetuating stratification and sex segregation in the workforce by making it uncomfortable for women to work in certain predominantly male employment sectors. So I think what we've realized is, yeah, there are a lot of cases of trivial forms of sex harassment. But, you know, fewer than 5% of the people who experience sex harassment actually bring a suit. Some of those suits are frivolous, but I think we've gained a lot more than what the cost has been in terms of vexation lawsuits in raising understanding of the significant ways that sex harassment gets in the way of work performance and educational fairness as well. So I don't want to totally diminish the enforcement costs, but I do think that law can be a powerful tool. And while I wouldn't defend all of the diversity training and required sex harassment education that now goes on, I think the cultural consciousness of this as a problem has made the workplace a lot more level playing field for women and for gays and lesbians who suffer a lot from unwanted sexual advancement and hostile work environments.
Suggestion that what we should really care about is whether or not the type of discrimination is plays out in a very systematic way. It seems like you conflate two types of systematicity. That is, on the one hand, the question that I thought you were putting forward was whether or not a person who might be understood as unattractive would face in one employer after another's discrimination. So that there's kind of a systematic discrimination from the point of view of the individual in the sense that all employers, one after another, would regard him or her is unattractive, and hence
right.
That person would face discrimination in a repeated fashion. Now, I would think that insofar as standards of beauty are consensual and fairly agreed upon, that indeed there would be that kind of systematicity that would be experienced in the context of experience or for looks discrimination. And hence that criterion, it seems, would be satisfied. And where you really have to come down hard is whether or not there's kind of social organization around this type of inequality.
Yeah.
And insofar as there's not adequate social organization, you think the litmus test hasn't been passed. But then that raises the question of why we care about social organization. Why is social organization such a fundamental criterion by which we make a judgment about whether or not a discrimination type of discrimination should be regarded as important? What makes social organization important?
I take it that what you're referring to by social organization is the way what I would call the interconnectedness of communities and the generational effects. So it compounds the problem. That's why it's so important. There's a difference between, let's take race as an example. When in the 1950s and 60s and before, it was entire communities that were excluded from the best forms of employment. So it wasn't just one person time and time and time again, but it was also everybody in their family who they might depend on for for sharing of resources, and everybody in their segregated community. So the entire community was brought down. And it wasn't just that it happened this year or in this generation, but the previous generation and the one before that and the one before that. And that created a type of social inequity that was much more severe than what could be created by something like weight or appearance discrimination, which isn't going to affect entire families, much less entire interdependent communities. Again, there are no ghettos populated by the overweight. And that same type of discrimination generated social attitudes that led to hostility and violence. And again, never heard of a weight riot or a looks riot. So those are the things that make it different. And I do think that that's what motivated the civil rights laws, but also what makes it so important that we continue to devote the energy and the resources that we have to devote in order to actually effectively enforce civil rights laws.
Yes. So this is one criterion for choosing among the various aspects of the appearance of this social systematicity, whether there's a systematic impact on it. But it seems to me there are other possible criteria that would maybe lead to different conclusions. For example, consider having or not having a law forbidding employers to discriminate against people who are obese. Well, there is a public health aspect to this, because if people could lose weight, and if there was a strong incentive for them to lose weight, then arguably national health costs would decline, because obesity is associated with all sorts of morbidity and mortality. Now, of course, it's true that people who are obese have a lot of trouble losing weight, and they go on diets, and they have this yo-yo effect, and it's very difficult. But the same is true for people who smoke, and I don't think that people usually argue, I don't know the law here, but I think that employers are allowed to specify that they will not hire smokers, and I don't think that violates any existing law. So why isn't obesity, as compared to other aspects of attractiveness, not in the same category, where the criterion is whether there's some overall benefit to public health and reduction of medical costs and so on? So it's a different kind of criterion. I wonder if criteria like that might be relevant.
I think so. It is worth noting that in the obesity rights movement, what you don't hear much about is the role of government food subsidies and the role of big food in promoting obesity. So it's not that people have weak wills, it's that we've got a society, and if you look at when the spike in obesity happened, it happened around the same time that big food started to use lots of high fructose corn syrup, that is subsidized through corn subsidies. These things aren't an accident. We've got policy, bad policy, that's generating obesity, and then, we turn around and say, you should be rail thin, and, only beautiful, you can't be too thin or too, whatever that phrase is. So there is a cruel irony there. But I think you're right to suggest that the solution for it isn't to say, let's have a law so that people can continue to eat as much high fructose corn syrup as they possibly can, and then we're going to expand the airline seats and make the employers ignore the objective effects. But instead, the reverse, to encourage through various ways the reduction of obesity. But part of that would be, to take on big food, and I think that would be the right direction to go. So I think it's a relevant criterion. And one last thing, it is worth noting that there are smokers' rights groups who do say, if we were black, they wouldn't, it's Jim Crow to have a smoking section and put us, so, these kind of analogies can get out of control.
Last, we've run out of time, so I'd like to thank both of our people.
Thank you.